You are listening to Latin Waves, a weekly syndicated program. For more information about our program, visit www.latinwavesmedia.com. Latin Waves Media is also now available on Twitter at Twitter/LatinWavesMedia.
My next guest is Bill Conroy. He is a journalist. He has covered the issue of the narco traffic and the drug war in Mexico. We're very privileged to have him on our show. He also reports widely for the Narcosphere Reporter's Notebook. Thank you so much for joining us, Bill.
Well, glad to be here.
Now, for many people, the issue of violence and drugs in Mexico has been something that's reported almost as a natural occurrence. It leaves the impression that violence is a natural thing that happens in certain geographical locations. Mexico, Iraq, are places that people naturally tend to associate with violence. But let's talk a little bit about how has the war on drugs really contributed to this narrative? And can you give us a little perspective of where was this narrative created and how has it been promoted?
I think this narrative has been around since I've been alive, and I'm credit 50 years old right now, so it goes way back. I mean, you find it in China, you find it all over the world. In this particular era, the way I kind of look at it is the free trade era. You have a prohibited product, and actually you have prohibited human beings, and on one side of a line, they're worth less than on the other side, and that has certain business implications. So that results in a lot of this violence occurring because people benefit from that status quo. And anytime you try to shake up the status quo, there's a reaction. And often, particularly along the border, it's a violent reaction. And I don't think it's a giant conspiracy. I just think it's the way the wheels have been set in motion since the discovery of the country, frankly. The discovery is kind of a misnomer, but since it was invaded, if you will, by the Europeans, you have the Spanish Empire colliding with the British Empire and the French Empire along the border. And some of those dynamics are still in place from that long ago, and just the way that the country's evolved, and the way capitalism has evolved and kind of become the, benchmark for the way things are done, particularly in North America and Canada and so forth. And South America, Latin America hasn't really benefited from that very much. That's kind of the big view from what I've seen.
In her book, Jasmine Ristoff draws a direct connection between the naturalization of violence and the concentration of capital for particular industries. She's particularly concentrated on the case of Colombia. In Mexico, particularly the border city of Juarez, there is a deep connection to the industrial production in maquiladoras and the narco violence, what has been called the green zone in the drug war. Can you explain what you mean by that, and what is this connection?
Yeah, I mean, I've been up in the Juarez, El Paso. Juarez and El Paso are sister cities. I mean, you can literally, in some places, spit across the Rio Grande from the U.S. side and hit Mexico. I mean, they look at each other all day, but they're like night and day. And what's happened in Juarez is a lot of U.S. factories have set up twin plants, they call them, or factories. They're called maquiladoras. And they employ, there's like 335 of them now. And they employ, 190,000 people, and they pay them $4 a day. Those same jobs on this side of the border are worth at least 10, 20 bucks an hour as opposed to $4 a day. So you can see the incentive to keep the factories there. And war is year-to-date. That's just this year-to-date. It's got about 2,000 murders. And it's a city that's lost about 250,000 people who have just fled, mostly middle-class-type people who can afford to flee. They've gone across to the U.S. side. So it's lost a good chunk of its population, but still a city of a million people. 2,000 people have been murdered, this so far to date. But there's only been one murder in the maquila zones, in the industrial zones, from 2008 through June of this year. That's it, one murder. It's mind-boggling. I mean, why is that? There's been a number of factors suggested, among which is the folks involved in the drug business. And the people involved in the drug business are a wide range of people, including what some people would see as legitimate businessmen who have to launder the money and you know, invest the money and benefit from the drug trade to, you know, the common thug on the street that has to be the enforcer. These shadowy figures the media creates that, you know, that are the mafia bosses and so forth. But the point is, somebody, all those different forces seem to have an interest in protecting maquila zones, you know, so they can continue to operate. And that's essentially what we mean by the green zone. It's a protected area from all this violence that's going on right outside the doors. So these people can go to work there and be fairly assured nothing will happen to them, but as soon as they get back to their houses, they could get a bullet in their heads. Because, and what's amazing about this is the people protecting these maquila zones are the Mexican military as well as the state police. And those same groups, many of them, you know, work for the cartels, are, you know, shooting at each other out in other areas of Juarez, but inside the maquila zones, they're working together to protect them. So there's just this strange dynamic in Juarez where it seems, you know, the way the media reports it and the way it probably comes across to most people, that it's total anarchy and that the Mexican military is the good guys trying to protect the city and they aren't able to do it. In reality, it's much more like a bunch of groups, you know, fighting with each other in designated areas where they're allowed to. But in certain other areas, it's clear that the protection from the Mexican government or whoever is in control of the Mexican government, it's very corrupted from within. It's like a cancer. And it's also, you know, people delude themselves that they think it isn't on our side of the border. It clearly is. That's how some of this is allowed to occur. And that's why things like the Merida Initiative, so $1.4 billion getting pumped into Mexico, much of that going to corrupt military and corrupt police. Why would we do that if we really wanted to stop the drug war? Well, because there's a lot of money in it for U.S. companies that are providing these goods and services, so they benefit. So there's no real incentive to stop this by the people that are making the decisions to escalate it and militarize it. And that's how all wars are. I mean, they tend to get a life of their own, and the reason for why they were started or even the hope of any kind of quote-unquote victory is long gone, you know, yet they continue on and people continue to die, and suddenly it just becomes a culture of war and violence, and then it's sold back to us because it helps people make money. I mean, newspapers get sold by printing drug war pornography, and defense contractors make money by selling helicopters to the Mexican military, and the drugs keep flowing. I mean, there has been no decrease in the amount of drugs crossing the border, and that's because people make money off the drugs, and so there's no incentive to really stop it. When you cover this stuff, after a while, you just kind of burn out on it and get real cynical, because it gets very dark very quick. You don't see real solutions to it, but every once in a while, you got to get snapped back into reality, and it gets brought down to a simple case of right and wrong. And it just, you know, this last week, I was out in a stretch of the border talking to two immigrants, right? And in that world, these people are vapors now, right? You're not going to find them. But they're telling me a story about how coming across the border in Texas, you know, a group of them, I mean, they didn't even know each other. They got hoodwinked by some coyotes and, you know, brought right into a border patrol unit on the other side, 50 yards outside, across the river. And one of them who was with this group was a 16-year-old kid, and he panicked, and he turned, and he ran, and one of the Border Patrol shot him in the back, and he dropped right there dead. And then they picked up the rest of the folks that, you know, the illegal immigrants at that point. Funny, they're legal on one side of the border, they're illegal on the other, is how it works, right? You know, picked him up, eventually, you know, brought him into the detention system, and within a day, all of them, they were all witnesses to this, were sent back across the border. And nobody knows what happened to that kid. There's been no media reports on that shooting. You know, who knows? I mean, suspicion is the body was kicked into the river, you know, and we discovered down the road and reported back to us is another example of, you know, Mexican immigrants, you know, foolishly trying to cross the border and running into, you know, bad things. Well, sometimes those bad things are us, you know, and we don't do much about it. It just becomes another story and another story.
And that's such an important point, you know, making the connections. As you point out in your report, while the violence is rampant in Juarez, Mexico, where over 2,000 people have died since 2008, there seems to be no signs of violence in the maquiladora factories, where more than 190,000 people are employed. You report that there's some 360 maquiladora factories. Now, we have to ask, who profits from this maquila industries? Because they seem to be the only growth industry in a time of recession. You report that over 24,401 new jobs have been created in the middle of a recession. How is this possible? What kinds of jobs, and who's profiting from this?
Well, I mean, these are, you know, Fortune 500 companies. These are big corporations that set up plants down there to make things. A lot of auto plants. I mean, GM has stuff down there. I mean, the range of companies, they come and go and they attract them, but it's essentially big companies that need parts and widgets made, and they want to get them made cheap, and they can down there. I mean, literally the wage is $4 a day for somebody or less, and they don't have to pay union wages. Heck, and not even close, they don't have to pay non-union wages that you would in the state. So you can imagine the profit margin on a widget that is in your car. I mean, we all drive these cars. And so, you know, a seatbelt, for example, which is one of the things that gets made down there, you know, they can probably sell that seatbelt. The company, the contractor that makes it for GM, could sell that seatbelt for, who knows, $400 or $500, maybe $1,000 to put all the seatbelts in a car and maybe make it down there for, you know, $40 or $50. You know, so there's a huge incentive for these companies to keep these factories open. They make a lot of money on them, and the people that are working there, frankly, are in miserable shape. There's been problems associated with the maquilas, and you know, since they became popular, and these are all along the border. Now, you know, I guess the argument is always, well, they're jobs, right? I mean, it's better than nothing. That used to work in the early 90s, or when Clinton signed the free trade agreement, NAFTA. It was hard to dispute, right? But what we've seen, and I think it's you know, most people would agree, of what the net effect of all this has been, is it's driven down wages for the common guy. It's destroyed the working class, at least in the United States, or contributed to it largely. It's actually done a lot to destroy the Mexican economy, because all the people coming up to work are coming up from the interior, because the other part of NAFTA, which is us being able to dump a lot of our products down there, has destroyed the farming system. The subsistence farmer just can't survive down there. So it's just completely wrecked the economy for the lower class and the working class in definitely Mexico, and I would argue the United States. It's made it worse. It hasn't made it better. So instead of jobs at factories, which weren't always great, but they paid good wages in the States, those are gone. Now you got to work at Walmart if you can get a job there for minimum wage. And look at the unemployment. The recession is no freak accident. Part of this recession isn't all about the housing bubble. I mean, the reason we were borrowing money to get us into this recession is because we didn't have any, because our middle class, working class got destroyed. So they were sold a bill of goods, use your credit cards. And it all comes home to roost. Here we are. And the violence, you know, is perfectly predictable in my mind, at least on the border, the way things work there, perfectly predictable outcome of all this, because there's three levels of violence in wars, as I see it. There's a street level violence that's always been there that is worse now because any sense of law and order in that city is gone. So, and then there's the, you know, mafia level violence, which is the drug violence, the drug cells and organizations, which has always been there, but it's been hidden. They, you know, they kill people and bury them. Now they kill them in the street and leave them out there. And then there's what is essentially the government and, if you will, multinational justified violence, the militarization of the border, which probably is the most deadly element of all of that, because it's got the most firepower, it's the most indiscriminate, it controls the justice system. So if that's corrupted, you have a Juarez. You have, you know, a situation where there is no justice, where the only justice is who has the most power, and it certainly isn't the little guy. And I spoke to a lawyer in El Paso, and who defends, tries to get some of these folks asylum on the U.S. side when they come across, and very few of them get it. And he explained it this way. What would happen to you, individual, as an individual, if you saw your mother shot, if you saw your sister shot, if you saw your brother shot, you saw your kids shot, and you went and tried to find justice, and there was none in Mexico, and you came here to try to find justice, and there was no justice here, and you were sent back to that, what would you do? What would you become? And then multiply that by thousands and thousands, and you have ORS.
One of the things that you have covered has been, you know, who are the workers in these maquiladoras? And primarily there seem to be women. The story that goes still uncovering Canada is the thousands of women that have disappeared, whose bodies have been found raped and murdered, and whose stories are not told. Where do you see the connection between this violence on the border that you call this militarizing of the border and the crimes being committed against a mass of women in Juarez?
I always like to point out that in terms of, and it's important, but it's not, it, just give me a chance to do this before you judge my statement. In terms of the sheer number and percentage of people dying in Juarez, it's men, mostly men killing men, but the reverse isn't true. It's not women killing men. It's not women killing women. But it is men killing women. Okay, that's what's unique about it. And they're the weak. I mean, in any kind of situation like that, and it's, I think it's human nature, and it's a sad part of human nature, the weakest people are the ones that are the most vulnerable and typically are the ones that are most preyed on. And what I mean by weakest, I don't mean in terms of intelligence or moral virtue or anything. I just mean in terms of physical weakness, the ability to defend themselves. And frankly, the women that have become victims, you know, these are, you know, sick, I can't swear on the radio, but they're sick people that are doing this. You know, some of it is just a really sad sense of machismo, right? Some of it is just, you know, there's no repercussion, there's no consequence for doing it. It's not that that it's accepted, it's beyond that. It's just, there's nothing to stop it. And there's always a percentage of people, you know, and in the male race, if you will, that are whacked that way. And if they're not somehow inhibited, and in particularly if they, and some of these people have a lot of power. I mean, some of these people, some of the theories about why these women were being killed is it almost became, you know, a game for some people that were really, you know, I mean, there's nothing to prevent somebody who was really perverted and sick from being a millionaire and having an immense amount of power to do this and know that he can control people under him and make sure there is no consequence for what he's doing. And so you have that, and you also just have the common, you know, idiot or person on the street who thinks they can get away with something, and then you have the, you know, the husband. I mean, domestic violence is not a unique thing to Mexico, but what is unique is if there's no consequence for killing your wife, or for beating up your kids. I mean, That's the problem, as I see it. Now, other people might look at it another way. So it's not a simple answer like one person. It's just a breakdown of the civil society that allows this to start. And once it gets going, you know, it's just the weakest people are generally suffer the most.
When I think of violence, I think that when we are constantly being surrounded by it, you know, when it's in our media, when it's presented as natural, when it's presented as normalized, it becomes part of the only narrative that we're entitled. And who has a voice to tell their story, right? When you see a border that is being militarized, where on one side we can call people illegal and on the other side they're human beings, and somehow by virtue of stepping one foot over a line, you are divested of every trace of being a human being, and now you are an object of legality or illegality. I think that's a very important narrative, you know, how people on one side can diminish the humanity of another simply by where they were born, by without looking at the economic conditions that force people to flee. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that way in which this this new call for a law, this law 1070 in Arizona, how it has exacerbated eliminated those divides that had been always fueled by racism, by sexism, by patriarchy, right? By this idea of who's dominant and who has a right to rule over another.
I think you just said it. I mean, I think those are all the factors that make it happen. And there is a media responsibility here for feeding misinformation and disinformation and riling up people or not informing people about the way things really are. And I run into them every day that are good people, but they work 12-hour days if they are not stressed out because they lost their job. And they get their narrative of the world fed to them on this level by Fox News. And what's dangerous about that is because we live in a democracy, you know, their votes count. So they vote based on that false narrative, and that keeps people empowered that actually are the perpetrators of these policies that are so destructive. In our school system, the same way. I can only speak to the states, but we've been in these high-stakes testing mode since the Bush era, and it discourages on all levels critical thinking, and it actually encourages, you know, basically, you know, memorizing or teaching to the test, if you will, so that you don't think outside the box, so you accept what you're told. You don't question authority. So there's a whole culture that's built up in, around this that, you know, wants you to be a good little worker and shut your mouth. And people that are in that mode, once their jobs are threatened, that's their backyard, that's their kids' future, what have you. And they're not informed right about what's really going on. They're told that the guy on the other side of the border is somehow less human than them, or and is coming here to threaten them in some way or take their jobs. Well, what do you think is going to happen? You're going to have a situation like you do in Arizona, where and it could spread easily. You just hope there's enough people that are paying attention that aren't, you know, sucked into this this vacuum that they call the media and have their minds distorted. And the good thing is, you know, some of the problems the media is having now with the internet and their institutions starting to buckle and shake. You know, even though I'm in the media, I think that's a good thing. I think it needs a good kick in the rear. it's caused a lot of problems here, and I think we need more voices, and I think we need people out there encouraging people to be critical and about the way they think and about the way they deal with other people, and not accept what someone else tells them is the truth, to actually take the time to figure out if it is the truth.
But part of that is also seeking information. How can people access your website and your reporting on the narco violence in Juarez? And
we're at narconews.com, and you just www.narconews.com, and it'll take you to our site. And there's a bunch of people that contribute to it, and we also do a school which helps to train journalists. So one of the themes of Narco News, and L. Giordano's the founder of it, and he went into Mexico 10 years ago with a laptop and created this thing. You know, adding to what I said before, people can be empowered to create their own media, to create their own narratives, so that you can have some pushback against this stuff. And the tools are out there to do that. And so one of the things they do is they train journalists to do that. And this Narco News is a collaborative where a bunch of folks contribute to it, and it's nonprofit. It doesn't accept commercial advertising. So that's what we're about, is actually trying to create a true narrative and people that are in the places seeing this happen and get out and cover it, not just repeat the narrative and plug in the script that gets fed to us every day from the wire services.
Thank you again for being with us. My guest is Bill Conroy. He's a reporter, a journalist reporter with Narco News. And for more information, go to narconews.com. Thank you again for joining us today.
It was good talking to you, Sylvia.
Take care. That was Bill Conroy. He is a journalist. And if you want to read his report on Juarez, you can go to Narco News, and his latest report was published on August 22nd, so just a week ago.
I'm going to finish out the show with a short clip from an Al Jazeera reporter in Juarez, Mexico. She reiterates carelessness of the Mexican government in shooting up neighborhoods irregardless of children and civilians. She also reaffirms the breakdown in civil society in Mexico, where very few of these villains are actually arrested or convicted. So I'm going to play that now.
Mi nombre es Luz del Carmen Sosa Carrizosa.
My name is Luz Sosa. I'm 40 years old and I'm a crime reporter in Ciudad Juárez.
Bueno, un día de trabajo.
Every day is different. For security reasons, I never go out alone. Always with the photographer. We listen to the scanner for police activities.
Aquí en Ciudad Juárez se puede decir que veo.
Here in Ciudad Juárez, I cover homicides, robberies, crimes. I see a lot of deep sadness. Because I cover funerals, I see the worst part of society, but also acts of heroism from people who have tried to save lives in spite of the risks, to rescue children from attempts to murder them. It's had a big impact on me to see bodies hanging off bridges or decapitated bodies on public roads. There have been shootouts in front of schools. The gunmen don't care that there are children here. Many innocent victims have died in this cartel warfare. Many children have died, some of them months old. In November of 2008, my colleague Armando Rodriguez was killed on his home doorstep. He was going to take his children to school, but they shot him from close range. The case still hasn't been resolved. Two prosecutors who took up the case have also been murdered. Since then, our newspaper, El Diario, has not published our bylines on high-risk stories. Our people decided a story would not be more important than our lives. We in the media do not work alone. When there is a killing, all the press goes together and leaves together so no one is singled out. Murders have become more cruel, using methods we didn't see before. Mutilations and decapitations are common. The exhibition of the victims is a tactic used by criminal groups to send a message to each other. The problem is that no one gets arrested, and also the state doesn't give us information. The government hinders your work, and it's a constant struggle between what you want to know and what they want to tell you. In spite of the pain and indignation for the murder of our colleague Armando, our duty is to keep doing our job without fear. I only protect myself with God's blessing. My job doesn't scare me, and I think that the day it does, I will retire, because I don't want to write in fear.
Cambia lo superficial, cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the US. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.